Hi, I'm Dan Cottrell, editor of Rugby Coach Weekly. You're about to jump into one of our podcasts. If you want to find out more about this podcast and also all of the great content, drills, activities, games and advice on the website, then go over to www.rugbycoachweekly.net. I hope you enjoy the podcast.
Now, coaches already get this. I mean, this happens in coaching where drills are obviously pieces of the complex repertoire that are pulled out and the athlete is given the opportunity to practice those, like taking shots on goal, taking shots on goal, taking a specific type of shot on goal. But when you don't understand the repertoire and you're not measuring it, it is very easy for coaches to just continue using the same drills, even though those drills are actually not improving the repertoire that they want to be improved. And they don't really know that because they're not measuring the behavior of the athlete.
Be the best rugby coach you can be. Welcome to Rugby Coach Weekly Podcast with head coach Dan Cottrell, where you learn hints and tips from the rugby coaching community. Let's get started.
Hello and welcome to Rugby Coach Weekly Podcast with me, Dan Cottrell. I am delighted to welcome onto the podcast Dr. Kimberly Behrens. Welcome to the podcast, Kimberly.
Thank you for having me.
So as you can probably guess by the accent, Kimberly's not in the UK. She is in New York. She is also founder of Fit Learning and CEO of Fit Learning Online and author of Blind Spots, Why Students Fail and the Science That Can Save Them. Fit Learning is a powerful system of instruction based on behavior science and the technology of teaching, and it aims to transform the learning abilities of children, which it does in the US, Canada, Europe, and Australia. So we're going to jump straight in, and actually we're going to talk about something that you didn't necessarily expect to talk about, which was your experience of your own children in sports coaching and in teaching. So just tell us a little bit about that.
Well, yes. I mean, it's been a long road as a parent who has, so my PhD is in behavior science, which is a branch of learning science, of which neuroscience is also a learning science, but I'm on the behavior science side of that. And so when you're an expert in how learning works, it's really difficult as a parent to watch your children being victims of ineffective teaching and ineffective coaching, which leads to their frustration and failure. And so that was a challenge for me. And look, luckily I started Fit Learning in 1998. And so my kids did a lot of Fit Learning in their lives. We got them reading and doing math and writing and thinking and all the things, you know, we didn't leave it up to the school for that stuff. But not so much in the sports department. Now, my daughter is my creative. And so she was never a sport. She never played sports. She did all the other creative stuff, dancing and music. And, you know, now she's in film school. She's my creative one. But my son is an amazing athlete. And he's been an athlete his whole life. He loves sports. And, you know, he played hockey for a really long time. He played baseball. He had a brief period where he played lacrosse. And now he's discovered crew, which I know is very familiar to your UK crowd, but he was at Henley last summer. So my son rose crew, varsity crew at a boarding school here in the States. And he's currently in the college recruiting process. But I'll tell you that, you know, watching a kid who's so naturally capable as an athlete, struggle and fail in sports because of ineffective coaching was really frustrating for me. And that was an area I really couldn't intervene because that's not my thing. Like I do academics and cognitive work. I don't do sports, but our field and our principles are extremely applicable. And so it would be so amazing for me if more coaches knew this stuff. So when you say ineffective.
And so you're looking in, and obviously you don't know necessarily the detail of the technical parts of what they're trying to learn, but you can see it's ineffective. So what were you sort of what was making you go,
and this is so many things. So similar, I mean, all my complaints would be similar to what schools do that doesn't work. So, you know, what would drive me insane was to watch coaches before and after practice just blabbing their mouths away with the boys sitting there, assuming that this stuff was, that they were learning this stuff. So talking about strategies for the next game or talking about how to do something with respect to, like in hockey, like how to take a certain shot or how to move a certain way. And they're just they're just blabbing words away, and the boys are just staring, which I know in it doesn't work like that in learning.
It work? So, I mean, obviously, the coaches there has got some expertise. They've seen your son maybe not take the right shot at the right time or use the wrong technique. So rather than blabbing or talking to them, what should they have been doing?
So, what we know in behavior science is that for behavior to be learned and mastered, it actually must be repeatedly practiced over time. And not only that, it must be repeatedly reinforced. So the fundamental principle of learning is the repeated reinforcement behavior over time is what establishes new behavioral repertoires. And so it's a combination of a behavioral and a neurological process. So new neuropathways are formed in the brain, and it's a symbiotic process of a behaving person, or you could say organism, because this applies to all mammals. But let's say you have a behaving person, they have to behave in the desired way repeatedly. And that repeated practice of that skill must be consistently followed by reinforcement in order for that neurological process to happen and for a skill to become what we call neurologically permanent. And so when you think about any individual in the world that has achieved expertise in a skill, whether it be an Olympic athlete, a professional athlete, a musician, a professional musician, none of those individuals achieved mastery of their skill by listening to a lecture about it. They only achieved or watching a video on how to do it. And then all of a sudden they can pick up a guitar and fluently play a very, I'm a classical guitarist. So I don't achieve mastery of my new pieces by watching someone else play them. I achieve mastery of my new pieces by breaking my pieces down into small sections and repeatedly practicing those small sections until I can play those small sections with fluency and ease and effortlessness. And then I gradually increase the amount I'm playing at a time until eventually I've mastered the whole piece and I'm playing it quite well. But I don't do that by listening to someone lecture me about the piece. I don't do it by watching a video on how someone plays the piece. I do it by a very specific type of training. And that's the same thing that happens in any repertoire that has to be learned, including sports.
So the coach is there, and obviously they've got to give out some information. But at the end of the game, it's not worth them just talking about it. They've got to find a way of reinforcing it. So what would you hope they're going to do? And there's a separate question coming about variability in a moment, but just in terms of what's more effective for that coach. Game's finished, sitting with the players. What needs to be said, if anything?
Well, number one, when you think about any kind of skill like this, this is a very complex repertoire of behavior, right? So when you think about what is required to execute the sport of hockey, for instance, I would probably posit to say thousands of component skills involved in that repertoire, but at a minimum, they're hundreds. And so the notion that a athlete can just start performing a very complicated repertoire all at once is ridiculous. Now, coaches already get this. I mean, this happens in coaching where drills are obviously pieces of the complex repertoire that are pulled out and the athlete is given the opportunity to practice those, like taking shots on goal, taking a specific type of shot on goal. But when you don't understand the repertoire and you're not measuring it, it is very easy for coaches to just continue using the same drills, even though those drills are actually not improving the repertoire that they want to be improved. And they don't really know that because they're not measuring the behavior of the athlete consistently. And they're not evaluating that performance with each individual athlete to say, okay, well, this kid consistently moves his wrist in this weird way, which is impacting his ability to get the puck off the ice and lift it, right? So the only way to fix that is to do something to target that wrist action. And so that drill needs to be changed for that kid. That drill needs to be changed. And the coach needs to say, actually, you need to go home and all weekend, you need to do this many times. You need to do this over, like this specific movement with your wrist. So It's like, you know, I think what happens is just like in school, you know, like these standard cookbook drills or these standard cookbook things get used, which actually aren't going after what's really missing from a specific learner's repertoire. And they're not individually designing a practice opportunity to hone in on that specific skill so the kid is performing it the right way over and over and over and over and having that skill selected by reinforcement, which is how learning actually works.
So it's interesting. You're talking about drills now. In the sports world that I exist in, there's a bit of pushback against the word drill, but I think we can probably see the understanding is that you're suggesting is it's not the same thing every single time. You are watching the player or watching the student in action, assessing what's improving and what's not improving, and then adjusting the next practice session with a different exercise, activity, or whatever, which then helps them do what's happening in the next one. So I've asked you to change your wrist position. Why can't I just use the same drill again or same activity and see you having better success?
Well, you could, but what if they don't? So here's what I'll say, and it's and this is the other big error people make who are involved in instructing people to do things that don't understand learning science, because you shouldn't change anything every day, because what we know about human behavior is that there's an unbelievable amount of variability during the learning process. So there's what we call bounce. And let me just, before we get any further, I've got to tell you that in behavior science, we measure every single thing a learner does in our presence. And we measure it with a very specific thing, and it's called rate of response. You could also think of it as frequency. And rate of response is count per time. So for instance, at Fit Learning, we measure count per minute of every single skill a child performs in a session with us. And then we plot those count per minutes that we've acquired on a very specific learning chart that allows us to evaluate the change in those rates over time. And the slope of the line produces something called acceleration. And acceleration is actually the quantifiable measure of learning in behavior science. So the steeper the acceleration or the slope, the faster learning's happening, the flatter the slope, the learning's not happening at all. And so we're constantly measuring behavior over time, and it's those measurements that we use to make the instructional decisions. So for instance, we would never just watch a kid and subjectively decide, oh, I think they're doing something weird, we should change this drill. We would never do that. We would actually operationally define what the behavior is that we're observing. We would count it in a timed period. And then consistently over practice sessions, we would chart those things on a tool. And then we would see what's really happening with the skill. Is it actually increasing in rate, and are errors dropping off? Well, if that's the case, then I'm not changing anything. But if errors are staying high and the corrects aren't changing at all, well, then this isn't being learned. And so I've got to make some type of change. And so then I'm going to say, what are the kinds of errors being made? Then I'm going to make an instructional change to modify something with respect to those errors. So what's occurring? Like, for instance, at Fit Learning, it might be that the child is consistently, like if you're talking about the reading program, a child is consistently mixing up the A versus S sound with the phonics, with vowels. So we're going to pull those out and do a explicit practice opportunity on discriminating between the sound of the letter A and the sound of the letter E before we mix those back in with all the letters combined. So it's those kinds of things, but we would never just do it based on our subjective observation. We're going to make those decisions and those changes based on objective measurement of behavior, which also isn't consistently happening in coaching or musical training or anything else. Like, a lot of this is done very subjectively, which is why a lot of people fail. A lot of people fail to acquire mastery of sports and music and lots of things because they get frustrated because it's just, they're not making progress.
Now, this sounds like it sounds in a sense slightly dangerous. And the danger here, not dangerous in bad news, is that we're not all PhDs in behavioral science. So you've got you would hope your college coaches would be pretty expert, but they're not going to be expert in all of these things. And they're now looking in, how can they make better judgments? Well, so let's say, how can an amateur coach make better judgments given that they can't obviously make the absolute, the spot on judgments that someone at the top of their coaching
Yeah.
career can do, that will make a difference.
Here's what I'll tell you. Everybody can count. I mean, this is what's crazy is that people get really like this happens in all because I'm in the world of education. And so I train teachers and practitioners all the time. And, you know, people get really scared when you say, you know, doing behavior science. But what I'll tell you is the remarkable thing is everybody knows how to count and everybody knows how to start a timer. And so I know you're thinking that, you know, measuring behavior requires some type of high level scientific degree, but I'll be frank with you. No, it doesn't, because anybody could start a timer for 1 minute and watch some and decide what you're going to count someone doing. And it might be how many times do they accurately, you know, hit the puck in the goal, or it could be how many times do they do the correct wrist action? Or it could be how many times do they put their body in the right position during a practice session of some sort. So counting is something we do naturally as human beings. We count all the time. It's just how you, it's what you're counting. You have to decide. And that's what coaches are experts in. Coaches know the techniques. They know the movements. They know what you need to be doing with your body. So what you need to be doing is counting, is that what your kid is doing? And if it's not, like how many times are they using the correct body placement? And then how many errors are they making in a 1 minute timed sample over a cup over like a week or 3 to 5 days of practice will get you a really good idea of where that learner is with respect to your what you're trying to teach them. Then you give them a new strategy to practice. And then you can see how does that change my count after the fact. So to be honest with you, counting and timing is not complicated. It really isn't.
Okay, so that makes great sense. And so I can see lots of coaches saying we can do this. Now, the thing about your daughter is in more creative industries, and, but all in creative areas. And we would watch something that there is creative. How do we count that? Because obviously that is more subjective, and that's it's like scoring in the Olympics for the ice dance. There are things in there where it's interpretation.
Right.
How are we going to deal with that?
Well, I'll use my own experience as a classical guitarist, because so I apply behavior science to I just did my practice before I jumped on this interview with you, which is hilarious. I spend about 4 hours a day on my guitar practice. I'm very serious about it. And I apply behavior science to my own guitar practice. So what that means is every single drill I have in my practice, you know, my practice, I guess you could say routine, I time and count. And I do this by videoing. I video myself in every practice session. And then after the fact, I go and I count my behavior. So I think you could also say that music is creative. Music has a qualitative aspect to it. So here's what I will say. When I have a piece of music that I've been practicing in drills, when I've mastered all the components and I consider that piece to be mastered in the sense of my measuring it, then what I do is I release the piece and I freely just play it and practice it and enjoy it. And it's in that free play moment where I give it the flair, where I start practicing, okay, actually, I want to pause here. I want to emphasize this note. I want to run into this note faster. I want to make this one quite quiet. And I want to make this loud. All those little qualitative nuances I do in my free play stuff. But I never move into free play until I've achieved zero errors and playing the piece at the target tempo for literally 5 to 7 days in a row. And then I stop measuring it every day and I allow I remove the metronome and I start just freely playing it and adding my pizzazz. But the only way I get it into the phase of being able to add pizzazz to it is when I've gone through that militaristic, consistent, very controlled practice of it. And then I like free myself up and let myself just play it and like mess around with different tones and different, you know what I'm saying?
So if someone's coming to something which they're potentially interested in, but they are then told you've got to do X amount of your term militaristic drills before they can do free play. I'm just worried there that that they might say, well, I want to get to the free play, but it's taking too long to get to the free play. So actually, I'm going
Right?
to
And
park
that's
this. I'm
what
going to
happens
go home.
all the time. That happens in education. That happens everywhere. People want to rush and jump over steps. Teachers want to do this all the time. Teachers want to get kids doing algebra before they know how to add and subtract facts. Because why? Because teaching kids to add and subtract is boring. And schools think that doing complicated advanced math is more desirable and it's where you should start. But I'm sorry, whatever you find to be boring or, that you want to skip over is why kids fail and can never learn algebra. And it's also why a lot of people never become very proficient in the skill they want to pick up as a hobby and learn. And a lot of people actually get frustrated and quit because they never improve. So I think that, and again, it's people's choice. I mean, I'm a nerdy PhD behavior scientist. So of course I'm going to, I know how to teach. I mean, I get paid to get people to get kids to be experts in academics. Like, and that's not just, I'm not getting kids average. Like fit learning, we get kids to above the 90th percentile and very complicated academic skills. So like we make kids experts, not average. And the only way to get someone to be an unbelievable expert at something consistently, efficiently and reliably is by applying behavior science. Otherwise, it's kind of luck, right? So, like when you think about the people who get really good at instruments but never use behavior science, of which a majority of people don't use behavior science in their musical practice, the people who become really proficient, they also, when you think about the amount of their lives that they devoted to that practice, right? Now, they might not have done it in the measured way I did, but a lot of mo the most proficient musicians they do some sort of measurement. They do some sort of very routinized, very disciplined, very structured practice because that is how learning works. It's the only way to truly acquire expertise in a skill is through very routinized, very rigorous practice of specific components of the repertoire.
So I
So,
mean, so I think the interesting thing here also is that I'm not trying to say there's a split, but we've got to look at people who are recreational learners
oh, for
against
sure.
people who are serious learners. So recreational learners may not be having to do or wanting to do all those things, and they will
True.
reach a level and they'll enjoy that level and they'll happily afterwards have a beer and enjoy.
Exactly.
And others who want to sort of take themselves to another level
For
need to
sure.
sort of take a leap over the not the
Yeah.
divide, but to do something there. So let's say I've gone over the divide and I'm now wanting to become more of an expert.
Yes.
Where's the first thing that I should be focusing on, or I should get my coaches to focus on? And if I'm a
There you
coach,
go.
focus on.
Yeah, I mean, everybody needs a coach, man. Like if you're, look, I don't need a coach for I don't need a coach for my guitar practice in terms of the instructional design part, in terms of the behavior science part, because that's what I'm an expert in. But I am not an expert in classical guitar. At the level of being able to teach others every aspect of the classical guitar. I mean, I'm still learning that myself. So I have a coach, right? Like I have a person who coaches me on important technical elements and about music and, all the things about classical guitar that I don't know. And then I translate that coaching into how I practice, which is guided by my science, right? So everybody needs a coach, man. So I mean, if you want to get serious about a skill, then what you really should do is identify an expert that is going to help you, number one. But a lot of
Oh,
times,
can I
even
just
that,
quickly tell you, you said instructional design, and I it,
yes.
that what do you do to design instructionally, or maybe I'm
Oh, yes.
so
Oh,
what happens
instructional
then?
design is like the most important thing for mastering any skill. Because when you think about, let's just take something like algebra, for instance. Let's go back to an academic skill. So algebra is a very complex math repertoire that is based on hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of component math skills that kids start learning in kindergarten. I mean, kids start learning the prerequisite skills for algebra when, I don't know if you have kindergarten in the UK, but kindergarten in the United States is like before first grade. It's like their first year of school. So kids start learning the prerequisites for algebra when they are five. But kids don't start aren't don't start learning algebra in school until they're around sixth grade in the United States. But what happens is when you
Oh,
have
sixth
kids,
grade, how old is sixth grade?
sixth grade is, you know, kids are around 13, well, 12,
Yeah,
not
okay.
12 years old. So when kids, but what happens is when you don't understand the essentials of mastering those components, when kids just get kind of exposed to them through like a curriculum in class, but then they are moved up to the next grade anyway, regardless of whether or not they truly mastered those skills, meaning they're neurologically permanent, they're fast and accurate, they can be performed in, at, you know, under any conditions. That's what true mastery means. Most kids don't master component skills in academics that way because schools aren't designed to produce that. So when you get to algebra, kids can't learn it because they don't have the pieces in place. So instructional design involves taking a complex repertoire of skills like algebra, identifying every single component skill required to perform that complex skill, and then designing instruction around producing mastery of every single skill on that. If you think about it as a ladder, every single skill up to the algebra repertoire. So instructional design is the design of instruction in such a way that that mastery is produced, not just exposed people.
I'm interested in the word mastery because what does it mean that I've mastered something? Where have I got to? Because I'm guessing that the best people at any discipline would never say they've mastered it because they're always learning. Or is there a sort of a stage which you go over where you say, yeah, I've mastered that, but I'm going to get better? Is that right?
Well, I think it depends on what you're talking about. So I think you could say that you would, like, I will never master the classical guitar. I mean, in terms of what like, it's just infinite. You know, you can get infinitely better, right? But I can master the E harmonic minor scale, right? So I think you're talking about what's the size of the repertoire you're talking about mastering. And so what we're dealing with are very finite component skills that kids need to master to be able to acquire high levels of proficiency at a complicated repertoire like algebra. So we actually do have quantifiable measures of mastery in behavior science and at Fit Learning that we apply to every single thing we teach with kids. And that's we know a kid at Fit practices the same skill over and over and over again until they achieve our measure of mastery. And at Fit Learning and in behavior science, mastery is talked about in terms of fluency. And so fluency, everybody knows that term. But fluency at Fit Learning is defined as a measure of accuracy plus speed, so count per minute, that produces three outcomes. Number one, neurological permanence. And so what that means is a skill is permanently learned and remains at a high level, at a high rate with low errors, even after periods of time without practice. So like you can stop practicing a skill and not use it as frequently, but it still shows up as unbelievably strong and fast and accurate when you need it. That's mastery. Mastery is also attention span. So another way we evaluate mastery at Fit Learning is when kids hit a rate of responding that allows them to continue performing at an unbelievably rapid pace without being distracted by other things. So noise in the background, not feeling great, any kinds of distractor can throw a disfluent learner off. But when you produce true mastery or fluency in skills, they're like machines. They don't notice anything else. They're so focused. So attention span is another measure of mastery. And then it's also the ability to apply that skill that they've mastered effortlessly to learn something harder. So we always are testing kids. Okay, after, you know, they've mastered their, for instance, multiplication and division facts to about 60 to 70 a minute is what we find to be fluent at Fit. Then we test how quickly can they perform multi-digit multiplication problems and more often than not, those become fluent almost without training because they are so fluent at the components. So there's actually there's an explicit evaluation of mastery at Fit Learning that is related to learner outcomes and rate of response.
Now, there's a couple of things that jump out. Well, the first one is seems like it's very heavy, time consuming to get there. So
yes.
So there's a child. They've got a normal school day to do all these things. How do they fit it all in and do all the other things that kids do?
Well, what's amazing is when you use science in your instruction, it's unbelievably efficient. So a majority of the kids enrolled at Fit Learning, whether it be our physical Fit Learning locations or Fit Learning Online, which is where we provide online instruction to kids who don't have access to a physical location in their region, whether it be either of those, these kids come as a supplement. And so kids attend 3 to 5 sessions a week, and it's a 50-minute session. And in a 50-minute session, in 40 hours, those kids have moved at least 1 year, if not 2 years, in the target academic area, which is unbelievably
Just going back there.
fast.
So 15 minutes,
50, 5-0.
five zero. Okay. 15 would sound even more impressive, but five, but still that's 50 is still a quite a, not an enormous amount of time to work on it. So I'm just gonna, so there they are, they're working away. Now you are giving them some exercises, activities. What happens if there's a range of abilities? Because not everyone's going to come in with the same experiences or the same abilities. And it may be that they've got very small groups, but a
We
lot of people
don't.
might
It's
be
all
listening and
one-on-one.
thinking, I like the idea of being far more efficient. But one of my problems is that I've got person A is probably a year or 2 years behind person B, despite the fact that both of them want to progress. Is there a way around that?
Well, yes. I mean, here's what I will tell you, and this is something that, we've been saying in behavior science since the dawn of our science, which was back in the 1930s. But what I will tell you is there's nothing that's the same between any two learners. I mean, literally, one of the most individualized aspects of human beings is our learning histories. So every single learner is going to bring a very different experience to the classroom, right? And they're going to have very different deficits. They're going to have very different strengths. They're going to have learned very different types of barrier behaviors. Barrier behaviors meaning things that get in the way of their learning, like staring into space, not paying attention to the lesson, mess fidgeting, talking to their neighbors, whatever it may be. Those are barriers, right? Because it gets in the way of their learning. No single learner is the same, and that's another problem, is that schools are designed with the assumption that kids learn in groups, and if kids don't learn as a group, there's something wrong with them. But that's actually completely erroneous. I mean, we know that's factually incorrect. So kids always learn differently. The learning process is the same, but where that learner is in their skill set, what they're good at, what they've had the opportunity to acquire mastery of, and what they haven't, what gets in their way of learning, that is going to be different. There is not a single learner at Fit Learning who shows up the same. And so what we do is, number one, we assess them with a very comprehensive skills assessment that allows us to see exactly what they are fluent in and exactly what they are not fluent in. And then we design a fluency building program for their deficient areas. That's not based on a group of kids, that's based on that one kid. And then every single thing we do in their session is based on that one kid. That's why we measure every single thing that one kid does and make decisions about that one kid. Now, we have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of kids, but every single kid is instructed as an individual learner, which is why we move kids fast and why we're effective. School doesn't work because they assume that the same teaching method, the same strategy, the same approach is going to work with every kid. And I promise you it never will, and it never has. It's impossible.
Forgive me if I get this wrong, but it'd be great if every kid had one teacher. But the practicality of this is that it's not going to be that way. So, how does a teacher or a coach create those sort of individualized learning designs based on the fact that they have such a range in front of them? So I understand that what we need to do, we need to work harder. And I think this is very important. A big lesson probably for us all is to, do I know enough about the journey this person's on, and am I designing things to help them? However, there is a time constraint, and we are faced with bigger groups than just one-on-one. So is there a way around that?
And so at Fit Learning, we provide a lot of coaching to teachers and practitioners. We have a whole series called the Scientist Educator series and in our scientist educator series, we actually teach teachers how to be scientist educators, which means applying science in their active instruction. And there is absolutely an unbelievably effective way to bring this into classroom instruction, even if you are teaching 35 kids. And what that requires is carving out time to check, to measure each kid's behavior, I mean, each kid's skill, performance of a skill, every single day. And you want to know how much time you need to get a sampling of a skill? 1 minute. 1 minute, which means that every day, if you have 35 kids, it would take you 35 minutes to get a measured sample of your kid's behavior on a skill, and then make decisions about how that skill's going for those 35 kids, give them each specific things to practice, and then give them way more opportunities to be at their desk practicing those skills. The amount of time that is wasted in schools on things that make no difference with respect to learning outcomes, because way too much content is, schools have the belief that they have to introduce so much stuff. It's all about content, 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 rather than about mastering essential skills and giving kids the time to actually master the fundamentals. Because when kids master the fundamentals, you have to spend very little time teaching the more advanced skills, because the fundamentals are so fluent. Kids can almost figure this out for themselves, but school has it all backwards. They expect kids to practice on their own, which they don't. And they spend the whole school day lecturing and introducing a bunch of complicated new stuff that kids can't learn because they still haven't mastered the fundamentals. So they're just wasting time. School could be done in a fraction of the time if it was about giving kids the opportunity to practice fundamental skills, teachers taking measurements of that practice at least once a day on each skill, making decisions, and then redesigning new practice for the next day. It's 100% possible, and it's what produces transformative outcomes for classrooms and makes teachers love their job, because teachers don't love their jobs. I promise you, high school teachers do not love their job when they are faced with a classroom of students who have not mastered any skills since kindergarten, but they're expected to teach them calculus and ancient history, and these kids still can't read. So it's a mess, but it's 100% absolutely doable in the classroom, and it transforms a classroom, transforms it.
Okay, I'm going to go back to a hat that I put on you right at the start as a parent. And yeah, obviously you are very keen that your children progress and become better. How as a parent, especially given what you know, how as a parent do you encourage them without them thinking, oh God, I'm going to have another conversation with my mother because they're going to be telling me, have you done this? Have you done that? Because actually I want to have a broader relationship with my children other than checking up they've done their homework, yes, or how they're doing at school. What would you suggest that parents do which can support, encourage without being sort of a heavy, oh God, here we go again, another lecture coming?
So I've written a lot about this. And one of the great articles that I think your listeners would enjoy is in something called, it's a online publication called Thrive Global. That's where it's published. And it's called How to Be the CEO of Your Household. And in this article, I provide, you know, a strategy for parents to do exactly what you're saying. And so, you know, and I'm the CEO of the Fit Learning Online organization. And I'll tell you right now, as the CEO, I would never pay my team off. I would never pay my employees for not working, right? I would never give them a paycheck for failing to work, for not coming to work, right? Not doing their job. And I would also never expect my employees to come to work without being paid. So I pay employees when they work and they actually do their job to the standards that have been set in my organization for job performance. And I would never expect them to come to work if they're not getting a paycheck, right? Well, those are two things that never happen in regular households. Parents have expectations that kids will do what they're supposed to do. And when they don't do what they're supposed to do, they typically yell and maybe get mad or they nag, right? And conversely, parents often pay kids off for doing nothing. And so what do I mean by that? I mean unlimited free access to things like screens, phones, iPads, video games, television, whatever it may be. Somehow this has evolved in our culture to be like a right of a child rather than a privilege that should be earned. So in my Be the CEO of Your Household article, what I talk about is parents need to start thinking about running their households like a business where there are earning schedules all the time, that their kids are always earning. And when you change that perspective in your household where your kids are on an earning system at all times, what that allows you to do is, number one, be very clear about the requirements, about the behaviors your child has to perform, the things your kid has to do to earn their paycheck, whatever their paycheck may be. If it's screen time minutes, if it's access to their, you know, if it's their allowance, which is, it should be both of those things. It should be their allowance. It should be their screen time minutes, and it should be their free time. And it's, what do you, you know, what kind of people do you want your kids to be? Slobs that lie around on the couch and expect mom to do everything for them and not really try very hard on their homework and throw a fit when they're asked to do anything and have a bad relationship with their siblings and generally be kind of punks? Well, that's not who I want to pay off. So the key is setting really explicit guidelines. Like, this is what's expected of you in the household. We expect you to get up at this time and have your bed made and your room in a state of nice, you know, in nice conditions. And you're going to contribute in the kitchen by putting your dishes away when you're finished with them. And you're going to contribute whatever, all the things a parent wants a kid to contribute. You're going to do your homework at night. And then when all these things happen, these are the things you earn. And if any of these things fail to happen, it's not a fight. It's not yelling. It's not screaming. Guess what happens? The kid doesn't earn the other thing. It's actually quite easy. It takes the emotion out of it. It's like, well, the reason you're not getting, why are you not giving me my phone? Well, you tell me why I'm not giving you your phone. Did you earn your phone today? Yes or no? Oh, like, what'd you not do? Oh yeah, my room's a complete mess. My clothes are all over the place. I haven't cleaned out the dishwasher. I have 17 cups and glasses and a dirty bowl in my room. I haven't done my math homework. So have you earned your phone? No. Okay, great. So whenever you're ready to do what it takes to earn your phone, you let me know, man. Like, just let me know when you've met the requirements to earn your phone.
Is there like an age for this? Because I'm sort of thinking that
no age.
I'm thinking my own children. if they're listening in, they're adults now, but they might be saying, I mean, it was hard enough to try and persuade them to do things when they were five, let alone when they were 12. Well, I mean, so for a 5 year old, when they're discovering lots of different things, I'm guessing that they're not on such a tight schedule.
You're gonna build up to this. So both my kids were on earning schedules by 3 years old. Well, they were on earning schedules all the time, but they just, you know, until they're about three, they don't understand rules, right? Like, you can't really put a rule-based earning system in place until your child can actually understand and follow a rule, right? But until an earning-based schedule is in place, then what you need to do is just be contingent with your reinforcement. And what that means is provide lots, like when they're little, when they're younger than three, so what parents have to understand is that whether you like it or not, behavior is strengthened by its consequences. That's how we've evolved to learn as a species. So what that means is whatever follows a behavior is going to either increase it and make it more likely to happen, or it's going to make it decrease. So reinforcement makes behavior strengthened and more likely and become habits. Okay. Reinforcement create habits. Punishment, it makes behavior go away if you're lucky. Oftentimes it also just makes behavior become sneaky. And behavior doesn't go away. Kids just get really good at sneaking those kinds of behaviors when you're a punishment user. Punishment is very, very ineffective and doesn't produce great relationships with children. So punishment should not be used. What should be used is lots of reinforcement, and then very mild to no reactions around inappropriate behavior, like no reactions to inappropriate behavior, because that oftentimes can be very reinforcing.
Yeah, right.
So when you have little three, you know, kids below three, what you want to do is provide, like, think about yourself as a vending machine for your children, because you are. So what do you want to be giving them? What do you want the vending machine to be paying off? Do you want the vending machine to be paying off whining and tantruming and biting and hitting and grabbing things away? You know, do you want that to be what the vending machine's paying off? Or do you want the vending machine to pay off using words, waiting patiently, being calm, being kind, sharing? Well, I know that I wanted my vending machine to pay off the latter things I just said. So what did I do? I tended to ignore the problematic behavior, and I reinforced instances of the behavior I wanted to increase. So when they would ask for things nicely, when they would share, when they, right? Like all those things I would intentionally, you're doing such a great job. You're the best. Hug, kiss, tickles, you know, attention. And then when they were being kind of turds, I ignored them. And oftentimes they'd have to go into a pack and play timeout when they were at play dates and would bite kids. Then I would just, without any attention, they would be removed and they'd put in a pack and play until they were calm. And then they were given, put back in the situation. And when they were playing and interacting nicely, it was lots of attention and reinforcement. And when they bit or hit a kid, they went back in the pack and play, right? Without any scolding.
So as a, with your, again, behavior scientist hat on now, we're passing hats around you quite a lot at the moment. Let's say I'm starting afresh with a 15-year-old. I'm listening in. And I think, oh, this is a good idea. But I've got a 15-year-old. We've never done the vending machine before. I've probably done all the things which are wrong.
Right.
I'm guessing that, you know, day one of this regime is going to be hard work.
Sorry.
So what would be the first steps to set up the vending machine?
So here's what I want to be like. This is another thing people tend to make mistakes about. Like they go for broke right in the beginning, right? Like I'm going to learn to play the classical guitar and I'm going to start playing this unbelievably complicated piece by Giuliani, who's one of a very difficult composer to play on the classical guitar. Like, no, you're not. That is never going to happen. So what's really important is for parents to understand the principle of shaping. And shaping is actually a principle in behavior science. And what it is basically everything I've talked about today, which is you have to build up to complex repertoires by starting with very small pieces, reinforcing those pieces until those are occurring at some strength, and then gradually increase the requirements. And this is what parents have to do. So if you have a 15-year-old thug living in your house who's just been given anything he wants whenever he wants it and has never had any requirements on him to do anything constructive or effective in the household, well, you've got a long road. So what you need to do is pick one thing that you want to shift, right? One thing that you want to shift. And then that one thing, you need to set a goal for that kid. So guess what? We're having a family meeting. We're shifting, you know, we are committed to you being a productive and effective member of society and in terms of getting you into this more effective and successful realm of your life, we're going to start by having you access your phone every day by cleaning up your room before you walk out of it when you get up in the morning. And if you know, and here's what I mean, your bed is made up, your dirty clothes are put in the hamper, and any dirty dishes are brought downstairs and put in the dishwasher. Those three things are required after you get up every morning and get dressed. And we're going to be doing room checks. And if you pass your room check, guess what? That accesses you, you know, some phone time before you go to school in the morning, whatever. Don't be like, okay, you're going to clean your room, you're going to do the dishes, you're going to do your laundry, you're going to, you know, that is way too much. So when you have your kid who's successfully achieving that goal, then you can start adding on new things. But when you add on new things, you got to increase the reinforcer, right? So I would keep, if you're only making them do one little thing, then the reinforcer should be pretty small. And that way, when you add requirements, then you increase the value of the reinforcer. So as the more you're requiring, the more expensive the reinforcer gets, right?
So yeah, you've got to have a budget within this, and I can see this, and I think people listening in and thinking, it's not easy, it's tough, and
but you also remember you don't have to use money, man. I want you to sit back and think about all the privileges your kid already has that you pay for. All the privileges they have that they just think are their automatic right. You know, like I think you got to start thinking maybe those things aren't rights. You know what your kid has a right to? Your kid has a right to safety, a household, warmth, love, clothing, a comfortable place to sleep, food, you know, healthy food. They don't have a right to junk food. They have a right to a healthy, nutritious food, but they don't have a right to junk food. They don't have a right to treats. They don't have a right to unlimited access to their phones and devices. That's absolutely not a right they have. They don't have access to unlimited access to your television and your cable and your streaming service. They don't have access. That's not a right they have. So I think you need to sit back and be like, what do I think are my kid are the rights my child has in my household? And the rest are privileges. And that means those are things you're already paying for. Those are things they already get, but they're just getting them non-contingently. And when I use the term non-contingently, don't be scared. That's a very fancy term in behavior science, which means they're getting that stuff for free. So you want to shift that and have them get all that stuff that they're already getting, but make it contingent on them actually being responsible for completing some things in the household. Because you know, our job as parents is to give our kids life skills, give our kids the ability to function in the world in an effective and successful manner. And that doesn't just happen by chance, man. We gotta set up, we gotta design that. We gotta do some instructional design.
No, that's brilliant. I'm thinking that I'm going to be on the phone to my kids. Like, you may be 27, but I tell you this, you're ringing me every other week to check in. Kimberly, it's been brilliant. I mean, there's so many things we can talk about, and obviously, there's a lot more sophisticated areas to discuss around fit learning and that sort of thing. So we're going to finish there, but there's plenty for the people
Okay.
to go and discover. Obviously, go to fitlearningonline.com. On there,
And
by the
also,
way, there are.
in general, there's fitlearningonline.com, which is for our online, you know, where kids don't have aren't in a region where they have access to a location. And then fitlearning.com is our general website for all of our physical locations. And also where you'll find information about our other programs that we offer. So our scientist educator training series for anyone, educators, I mean, anyone who's trying to teach human beings to do stuff, benefit from the scientist educator. We also do, we have a program for schools called Fit Light. And then all of our locations are on the Fit Learning website. So we have fitlearning.com and fitlearningonline.com are both great resources to check out if you want to get more information about being effective at getting people to learn stuff.
Yeah, which is great, which is what we want people to do. So we'll definitely, those links will be in the show notes. Obviously, the book Blind Spots, Why Students Fail and Science That Can Save Them.
That's another thing I should probably shameless plug. Like,
Oh,
that's another
definitely should do.
that I should I forget this, and my publisher gets annoyed with me, and she's like, you know, you do have a book you need to talk about sometimes. So, Blind Spots is a really great resource for parents. I know that it sounds, you know, I am a behavior scientist, but this book was written for the public. So I wrote this book such that it's readable for people who don't have a degree in my field. So it's really written for parents, educators, like anyone who's interested in learning, anyone who's interested in why human beings have a hard time learning stuff and why a lot of people fail to become experts at stuff. That's what the book's about. And it provides a link to how behavior science is the answer to particularly the education crisis that is worldwide. It's not just based in the United States. There's a lot of countries struggling with educational outcomes. So thank you for mentioning my book because I always forget.
No. And I will a bonus point from your publisher for both of us. I'm glad to say.
Thanks.
It's been brilliant. This has been a Rugby Coach Weekly podcast. If you want to find out more about Rugby Coach Weekly, go to rugbycoachweekly.net and click on the podcast button to find out more. There'll be more links to what we've been talking about in the show notes. But Kimberly, that's been absolutely brilliant. I feel that any child who comes across me now will be in a better place, even if they don't think so for the first few months, years
Well, I hope
with
so.
me.
I really
Say, the
appreciate you
vending
having me
machine. They'll
on.
call me the vending machine.
Yes, think about it. Be a vending machine. What are you paying off? right?
Yeah,
What are you paying?
excellent.
Always say that to yourself. What am I paying off right now? This also applies to significant others,
Yeah. No,
partners.
I've been noting that too, yeah. And the dog, the dog's had it.
Dog, they reply, hey, your pets.
Yeah,
But
brilliant.
thank you so much for having me on. It's been a blast. I've really enjoyed talking to you.
Great. Thank you very much, and thank you everyone for listening. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Rugby Coach Weekly Podcast. If you want to hear more podcasts, head over to rugbycoachweekly.net and click on the blogs tab to catch up on any episodes you've missed. We look forward to speaking to you again soon with more insights from coaches and experts from the world of rugby, sport, and learning.